I think we're joined by Stephen Gowans. Are you there, Stephen?
I am. Hello, Phil.
It's good to talk to you. And you have a new article at What's Left, and it's titled Aspiring to Rule the World, U.S. Capital and the Battle for Syria. And this is very pertinent to us all today. You take up this matter, and it's very, you know, this expression, rule the world, of course, sounds sometimes like something from a comic book, but actually it's fairly apt, isn't it, that the U.S. has defined itself, as I read in your article, first of all, as a great, you know, powerful sovereign state, and then it has an expression which you go after, and that is they have interests. And you ask the question, well, what could that possibly mean? If you're a democracy, you have interests in other places in the world. So could you elaborate on how they lead us down the garden path by raising this odd expression, interests?
Yeah, and I should also mention that while ruling the world may sound like a comic book expression, it means the same as certain expressions that the U.S. foreign policy establishment uses unabashedly, and expressions such as established primacy, or we must have the leadership role in the world, or we're the indispensable state.
The indispensable, the exceptional indispensable. Talk about tempting the gods.
But it's quite clear if you read U.S. foreign policy documents that there's an expectation that the United States will be the principal country in the world and will play the prime leadership role, and that it will not tolerate any other country encroaching upon its status as the principal country on the globe.
Yeah, it's sort of, by the way, as I read your article, it's pretty clearly, and I'm sorry to have started with the expression comic book, but it's pretty clear that if you wish to be part of the circles, and I want you to name some of these powerful circles of people, that's pretty much on your membership card, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those you say the I think it's foreign policy, the Council on Foreign Relations.
Yeah.
Of which I was surprised that you pointed, Human Rights Watch is a member.
Well, there's an interlock between the very influential foreign policy organization called the Council on Foreign Relations and the Human Rights Watch, and also the International Crisis Group. But there's also a substantial interlock between the Council on Foreign Relations and the United States government.
So when they talk about the world, it's not an accident that they simply adopt the biases, foreign policy biases, of the ruling group.
Yeah, that's right. And
they no wonder they look somewhat surprised if you say that to them, because their answer is, of course.
Of course, yes, we are the leader in the world, or that's their view, and we have vital interests across the world. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's very rarely, if ever, said exactly what these vital interests are. They simply exist and must be defended. But few people ever ask, well, exactly what do you mean by vital interest?
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting to inquire into what could possibly be meant by that, and also to ask why it is that the United States government wants to be the principal country in the world, why it wants to lead the world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can come up with all kinds of, we could say, comic book explanations for why they want to be leaders in the world. You know, something that had to do with exercising power and being able to call the shots. But mm-hmm. why do they want to call the shots, and on whose behalf, and to what end?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's important to inquire into that. In my thesis, if you're going to just describe it briefly,
mm-hmm.
Could be described in connection with three questions. The first is, who shapes foreign policy in the United States? And I think the answer is, major investors and bankers and key corporations.
Mm-hmm.
Second question is, what kind of governments has U.S. foreign policy been hostile to? And if U.S. foreign policy is being shaped by business interests, you might expect that U.S. foreign policy would be hostile to governments that are hostile to U.S. business interests. And if you look at this, since World War II, Washington has intervened directly or through proxies in countries whose governments have attenuated the space for U.S. enterprises and investors to make profits, you know, either by the state playing a significant role in the economy or by the state assigning productive assets to workers and farmers rather than making them available to private investors. If you can go through the list, you know, starting after World War II, the United States and the Cold War being hostile to the Soviet Union and its allied socialist countries, obviously countries who organize their economies in ways that are hostile to the profit-making interests of U.S. enterprises. Mm-hmm. And if we bring this up to today and look at Iraq, for example, Iraq's economy was almost entirely state-controlled. So is Syria's. Iran's economy is largely state-controlled. And I don't think it's an accident that the United States or U.S. foreign policy is hostile to countries that provide little room for U.S. enterprises and investors to make a profit. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can ask then, how does Syria fit into all this? And I think it fits in two ways. The first is that the government does play a significant role in the economy. And if you look at State Department documents prior to 2011, you'll see a lot of complaints about Assad's socialist ideology. Assad is by no means a Marxist socialist or the kinds of socialists you would have seen in Eastern Europe. He's an Arab socialist, but that kind of socialism involves a considerable state control of the economy.
Disrespect for the free enterprise is practiced in the West.
Exactly. And then the second reason for U.S. foreign policy to be hostile to Syria is because it's the last bastion of an Arab nationalism which rejects the idea of U.S. economic domination of the Arab heartland and seeks to bring the, you know, the vast petroleum and other resources of North Africa and Southwestern Asia under the control of the people who live there for their own internal development. Mm-hmm. Not for the benefit of U.S. oil companies or U.S. banks or U.S. investors or U.S. arms suppliers. You know, I read something that really astonished me in the last week, and it was about defense budgets in the world. And I was astonished to discover that the fourth highest defense budget in the world is that of Saudi Arabia, just below Russia.
So we have the defense budget.
Yes, the United States, so military expenditures. The United States, China, Russia, then Saudi Arabia. And that's money that's essentially being sent to the United States to purchase arms from the U.S. arms industry.
That's like laundering.
Yes, exactly.
The Americans are just giving the money to themselves through a family called the Sauds.
So rather than using the proceeds of the sale of these vast petroleum resources to develop the Arab nation economically, the Saudis are simply recycling the money, giving it to the United States to buy massive amounts of weapons. I'm not sure that Saudi Arabia needs to have the fourth largest arms expenditures in the world. But
They don't even have any soldiers to speak of. They hire them. They just recently hired Colombians to fight in Yemen, I understand.
Yeah, exactly. But you know, I think this kind of Arab nationalism, obviously Saudi Arabia isn't expressing any Arab nationalism, but one country that did express a fair degree of Arab nationalism was Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we've had the United States intervene in Iraq, or had intervened in Iraq since the early 90s after Saddam Hussein had invaded and made it
Kuwait.
And, you know, you can always ask the question, well, you know, why did the United States intervene? Was it really because they wanted to drive Iraq out of Kuwait because Saddam Hussein had violated international borders? Well, I don't think that's particularly compelling, since the United States, for example, is supporting Saudi Arabia today. mm-hmm. violating an international border. The United States doesn't really seem to care all that much about invasions.
Mm-hmm.
But when you look at this from the perspective of Arab nationalism, and then look at what principal figures in U.S. foreign policy have said about the reasons why the United States intervened in Iraq in 1991 and then later in 2003. And you'll see they talk about things like, well, you know, Saddam Hussein was in a position in which he may have been able to monopolize control of Middle Eastern oil.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't want him to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Dick Cheney had said about the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, he said, you know, armed with an arsenal of weapons of mass destruction, which, of course, Saddam Hussein didn't have, then
mm-hmm.
seated upon 10% of the world's oil reserves, Saddam Hussein could be expected to seek domination of the entire Middle East, take control of the world's energy supplies.
Yeah.
They've always presented this idea that there are going to be Arab nationalists like
yeah. Saddam. By the way, there is real comic book work by Mr. Cheney,
mm-hmm.
as you exposed. Please go ahead.
No, real comic book work. Part of the comic book work there are two issues. Number one, there's a suggestion that somehow Arabs shouldn't be able to control their own resources.
Yes.
But secondly, that they could take control of the world's energy
yes.
supplies, as if all of the world's energy supplies are located in the Persian Gulf.
That ain't so.
And the U.S. foreign policy establishment has for many years tried to promote that idea, and many people believe it to be true.
Mm-hmm.
So they believe that the United States must intervene in the Middle East in order to preserve security of supply and to preserve the U.S. way of life, which depends on access to oil.
Mm-hmm.
But the interesting thing about this is that the United States has never been particularly dependent upon Persian Gulf oil. And in fact, it hadn't really begun to import Persian Gulf oil until the mid-70s when U.S. consumption of oil outstripped supply.
Mm-hmm.
But even then, the amount of oil that was being imported from the Persian Gulf was rather insignificant
mm-hmm.
In comparison to the amount that was sourced domestically, because the United States, which is not often recognized, is a major producer of oil. In fact, it's the third largest producer of oil in the world today, behind Russia, and I can't recall the other one.
So they use it only as a convenient argument to alarm people. But if I understand you, your thesis is that actually, no, what the key thing is, they want world hegemony, right? And anyone who brooks that is going to be in for trouble.
Yeah, and they want hegemony in the Middle East, not to preserve security of supply, but to protect this vast, reserves of petroleum in the Middle East from Arab nationalists, to ensure that U.S. oil companies continue to derive considerable profits.
Mm-hmm.
And if we look at, the United States oil companies have been weren't importing Persian Gulf oil and bringing it to the United States. What they were doing was that they're selling it to Western Europe and to Japan and to third world countries.
I think the figure I saw in your article was 80%.
Yes.
Was they weren't taking it to the U.S. They were selling it. 80% of it they were selling to others. By the way, the title of the article is Aspiring to Rule the World, U.S. Capital and the Battle for Syria, and it's in What's Left, and it's gowans.wordpress.com. Could you talk, in the last minute here, could you tell us about the sort of the relationship, the billionaire and almost billionaire people who belong to the key groupings that make policy? You have a very nice discussion of people like John Kerry, and you mentioned Mr. Brenner, who was our governor in general over Iraq, and what does it take to be a member of that club?
Yeah, the Council on Foreign Relations, immensely influential in setting foreign policy. And it's a club that's it's essentially a private organization. It has a board, and it has a chairman. The chairman has had for many years been Rockefeller, who continues as the honorary chairman. But the board members are generally billionaires, prominent business people, or near billionaires. And they select the members of this exclusive organization. There are 5,000 members, so you have to be selected. Mm-hmm. And the members include prominent media figures, prominent business people, prominent members of the state, prominent generals and admirals mm-hmm. and leading military figures. And what they do is they get together and they make recommendations about foreign policy, which they transmit to the U.S. government and they promote in the public. They are, and we just talked about how they're interlocked with Human Rights Watch and the International Crisis Group, but importantly, they're interlocked with the U.S. state. So 17 key and former members of the Obama administration are members of this billionaire-directed private club. Mm-hmm. Everyone in the cabinet is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Mm-hmm. There's been a major study done of the Council on Foreign Relations recently, and the person who did the study, Lawrence Shute, went from the Carter administration going forward to Obama and found that 80% of all of the key cabinet positions, which he named as Treasury, State, Defense, CIA Director, et cetera, that 80% of all these posts had been filled by members of the Council on Foreign Relations, most of whom were members of that organization before they were appointed to their positions. Yeah. And, you know, you can go through the list. The list is, the membership list is available online. I went through the 5,000 names on it.
Wow.
And you can go through the 5,000 names and you look at who these people are. There's a fascinating number or fascinating people there, but, you know, secretaries of treasury, 10 of them, living ones, are in the Council on Foreign Relations, 10 national security advisors, 9 U.S. UN ambassadors to the UN, 8 secretaries of state, 8 secretaries of defense, 8 CIA directors, 4 chairmen of the Joint Chiefs, and the list goes on and on. Mm-hmm. Then you see dozens of prominent media figures, I mean, leading media figures in the United States, and presumably their role, they've been co-opted by the organization to promote the kinds of foreign policy positions that this billionaire-directed club favors.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, as we now know from Ralph Nader and so many others, that this moneyed group, which is not a terribly large number of people, fund the political parties and determine who becomes the president of the United States and Congress.
Yes, and Congress, and I think many, a significant proportion of the members of Congress are millionaires. Mm. And the New York Times had not too long ago an interesting article that showed something like, I think it was 158 families had contributed half of the campaign contributions to the current presidential race. I think it was just 158 families. And they gave an example of one of the leading contributors had spent $300,000 on various Republican aspirants to the, you know, the Republican mm-hmm. presidential banner. $300,000, way beyond, you know, the capabilities of an average citizen. But when you looked at this guy's income, you discover that the $300,000 was less than 1% of his monthly income.
So, yeah, finding a good servant is pretty cheap. It's not a demanding thing. It's not as though they're saying, "Hey, I'm holding out for more." They're on the take.
Which is
kind of what Bill Clinton looks like.
So, you know, billionaires, financiers, people with all this money that can have an enormous influence on U.S. politics by spending just a very small portion of their income.
Yeah,
It's easy for them to do.
Yeah. Well, I tell you, Stephen, it's a great article. This is Stephen Gowans. The title is Aspiring to Rule the World, U.S. Capital and the Battle for Syria. Of course, it's what's left, but it's gowans.wordpress.com. And thank you very, very much, Stephen.
Thank you, Phil.
Nice to talk to you. Bye-bye. We'll talk shortly with Zafar Bengash. I really recommend that article. I'm sorry I didn't focus as much as I might have on Syria, because he uses the word battle, the battle for Syria. And, of course, Syria is one of those that is does not bow to or make its policy based on the ambassador of the United States, and therefore has come in for the title of necessary regime change. And so this is the part that we need to confront, frankly, is do you have to be a pigeon for the Americans in order to have your own government?